This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Now I have a confession to make in advance, a trigger warning, if you will, especially if anyone here happens to be under 18, and I don't think you are. I will have to use some vulgar language today, because without it I can hardly explain what Joyce does in Ulysses with the fascinating topics of marriage and sex. But I want you to understand that when I signed the contract for this X-rated lecture with the Lannan Foundation, I obtained a commitment for Patrick, from Patrick himself, that I would definitely not be pandied for using vulgar language, because I will simply be quoting the words of Joyce, whose hands are no longer available for anyone to strike. But in that connection, I can't help recalling the story of a grand English duchess who was sitting in the drawing room of her magnificent house, think Downton Abbey. She was having tea, and on the tea table, along with the tea things, were two remarkable things. One was the skeleton of the hand of St. Anthony, preserved in her family for generations, a precious relic. The other was a beautifully carved ruler dating from Elizabethan times. And as she sat at the tea table with these things in front of her and looked out the window, she noticed the sky darkening, clouds gathering and thickening, and suddenly lightning flashed, and she heard a terrific crack of thunder which struck the magnificent old oak at the end of her lawn. I realize I've made one crucial mistake. Before that happened, as she saw the lightning flash, she prayed to St. Anthony that he would spare the magnificent oak, 150 years old, at the end of the great long green lawn. But just at the moment when she was praying that her magnificent oak would be spared, lightning struck the oak tree, split it down the middle, and left it a charred hulk, whereupon she picked up the ruler and rapped St. Anthony on the knuckles hard. My topic today is, first of all and last of all, marriage, which has inspired a vast number of literary works for the very good reason that it plays a vital role in nearly all of our lives. I come to this topic with a certain amount of personal as well as literary experience. 12 days from now, my wife and I will celebrate our 50th wedding anniversary. If I look a little young for that event, it's only because I'm an incurable case of arrested development, as my wife will be ready to confirm. And of course, given the inescapable contingencies of life, I can't be 100% sure that our marriage will last another 12 days. But I suspect that it will. And in any case, my nearly 50 years of marriage and of knowing other married people prompt me to venture a few generalizations about marriage, one of which is that Tolstoy was dead wrong. In the famous opening paragraph of Anna Karenina, Tolstoy makes two generalizations about marriage, one of which is that all happy marriages are alike. In saying this, he strongly implies that all happy marriages are not just grounded on the rock of fidelity, but also scored in perfect harmony, blissfully free of conflict, resentment, repression, jealousy, and suspicion, of all the things that can complicate a relationship between any two people who have vowed to have and to hold each other until death do them part. I am heretical enough to doubt that any such perfect marriage ever existed. And it certainly doesn't exist at 7 Eccles Street, where Leopold Bloom lives with his wife, Molly. If their marriage is happy, and for now I leave that as a very much open question, if their marriage is happy, it may tend to suggest a radical revision of Tolstoy's famous dictum. There is no happy marriage without some degree of contention, and each happy marriage is contentious in its own way. I can't help recalling just one or two examples from the marriage of my own wife's parents. As her father was leaving the house one morning, he told his wife to get a cleaning woman because at the end of the day, he didn't want her all tired out from housework. When he came home, spoiling for an argument, he wanted her in fighting trim. On another occasion, a minor earthquake struck their neighborhood while he was out working in the garden. As the house shook, his wife stepped out to ask, "Lyle, what are you doing?" He later said he'd been accused in his life of many things. That was the first time in his life he'd been accused of causing an earthquake. On Bloom's Day, the marriage of Leopold and Molly Bloom is struck by the earthquake of adultery. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when Leopold is out wandering the streets of Dublin, a flashy concert promoter named Blazes Boylan, what a wonderful name, comes to see Molly, ostensibly to discuss the program for the concert tour of her soprano voice, but actually to go to bed with her. This event makes Bloom a cuckold, which is a funny old word that means simply a married man whose wife is cheating on him. The cuckold is a stock figure in literature. In works ranging from Chaucer's Canterbury Tales to the great comedies of Molière, the cuckold is typically a rich, jealous, stupid old man married to a sexy young wife who is ripe for the plucking. In one of Chaucer's tales, in fact, a young wife walking in a garden with her literally blind husband climbs up on his back and into a pear tree where her handsome young lover is waiting for her. Talk about a fruitful embrace. Traditionally, then, the cuckold is a blind and jealous old fool, a target of ridicule and contempt. And as readers or viewers, we are typically invited to take the side of the adulterous young lovers for outwitting an old man who stupidly thought he could manage and satisfy a woman much younger than himself. This literary tradition of the cuckold gives us a lens through which to read the character of Bloom, not so as to reduce him to just another example of a stock character, but so as to see how radically Joyce has reconceived the figure of the cuckold. I'm sure you've all heard the old dictum that art imitates nature or imitates life. To some extent, though, each new work of literature imitates an old work of literature, as Joyce's Ulysses imitates Homer's Odyssey. But as I tried to show the last time I was here, Joyce doesn't copy the Odyssey, he radically rewrites it. And likewise, in creating the character of Leopold Bloom, he radically reconstructs the figure of the cuckold. First of all, Bloom isn't an old man married to a young girl. He's 38, which I think most of us would consider just the beginning of middle age, and his wife is 33, or nearly 34, just 4 years younger. Bloom married Molly when he was 22 and she was 18, and they've now been married for 16 years. Secondly, though you would never know it from eavesdropping on Bloom's self-effacing thoughts, he is handsome. Distinguished enough, in fact, to look something like a matinee idol in the eyes of a young woman named Gertie McDowell when she sees him from a distance on Sandymount Strand in the early evening of Bloom's Day. Another thing that separates Bloom from the stock figure of the cuckold is that he is most definitely not blind to what his wife is doing. From the morning of Bloom's Day, he knows that she is going to commit adultery later that day. He knows it as soon as he returns from his little shopping expedition. He goes out to buy breakfast and comes back to find a letter from Blazes Boylan on the hall floor just inside the door to his house. When he sees the letter addressed in a big, bold hand to Mrs. Marion Bloom, we are told, his quickened heart slowed at once. In part because in early 20th century Dublin, the proper form of a married woman's name was Mrs. plus the name of her husband. In fact, that was true in this country. Years after my father died, my own mother's name in the phone book was Mrs. Roy Heffernan. It did not change. Right? Since Bloom is identified as Mr. Leopold Bloom in the first sentence about him, Mr. Leopold Bloom ate with relish the inner organs of beasts and fowls, since Bloom is identified as Mr. Leopold Bloom in the very first sentence about him, his wife should be Mrs. Leopold Bloom. But instead, she's addressed as Molly. And in thrusting aside the name of her husband, the bold hand of the writer pushes Bloom himself aside as a prelude to reaching for Molly and steering her into bed later that day. Bloom not only foresees this tryst, he actually delivers Boylan's letter to Molly while serving her breakfast in bed. And if you think this makes him an utterly abject go-between for his wife and her lover, you can't possibly think worse of Bloom than he does himself. In the Nightmare of the Circe chapter, where Bloom relives all the humiliations of his day in a series of late-night hallucinations, he sees himself at one point as an antlered flunky, a servant with horns, which typically signify a cuckold. As an antlered flunky in this hallucination, Bloom greets Blazes Boylan and ushers him into Molly's bedroom, where Boylan tells Bloom that he plans to conduct a little private business with your wife, you see. And he tells Bloom, you can apply your eye to the keyhole and play with yourself while I just go through a few times. I warned you. Here, of course, Bloom is reminded, or rather reminds himself, of what he did in the early evening on Sandymount Strand. Up to that point, he's been brooding on the inevitability of Boylan's bedding of Molly. At Sandymount, he finally masturbates while gazing from a distance at Gertie McDowell's underwear. quietly, I should say, masturbates while gazing from a distance at Gertie McDowell's underwear. Several things are worth noting about this act, which is, first of all, very funny in context, because while Bloom is masturbating, Gertie McDowell is gazing at him with something like adoration. She not only sees him as a matinee idol, but also imagines him as thoroughly noble, a man of honor to his fingertips. And, of course, she has no idea what those fingertips are doing. But if we laugh at Gertie's idealization of Bloom, we also have to chuckle at our own impulse to sanctify him because of his suffering, to see him as a Christ figure, especially when he identifies himself with Christ in his argument with the Jew-baiting, Jew-hating citizen in the pub. As you may recall, Bloom defiantly tells the citizen, "Christ was a Jew like me." But Bloom is not a saint. He's human, all too human, seeking pleasure wherever he can find it without hurting anyone else. This is why he wants to ogle the swinging hips of the girl he finds at the pork butcher's on the morning of Bloom's day, why he's so impatient to get out of the shop and watch the girl walk on ahead of him. It's also why he gets himself quietly excited by the sight of Gertie McDowell's undies. He's not a flasher. He doesn't accost Gertie or even speak to her. He simply takes a bit of pleasure while looking at her. And given the day he's had up to now, including the funeral he's attended, and especially the battle that he's had with a citizen at the pub, given all that, who can blame him for what he does with his fingertips in his own pocket? For this relief, Bloom says, "Much thanks." That's from Hamlet, as he tells himself. So Bloom is a cuckold, but he differs from the traditional cuckold because we don't see him from the outside as a blind, jealous old fool. We see him from the inside as a man who knows that his wife is cheating on him, but feels powerless to stop her, or even to take on her lover the kind of revenge that Homer's Odysseus takes on the suitors who have laid siege to his wife. Bloom is simply not a vengeful man. Except for the one moment when he strikes back, rhetorically, at the citizen, he doesn't retaliate against his tormentors. He suffers their ridicule in silence. On Bloom's Day, he has to live with the knowledge that he is seen as a cuckold, that everyone he meets, or every man he meets, knows that Boylan is her lover, and worse still, that she's letting Boylan into her bed and into her body because Bloom himself can't satisfy her. And this topic returns every time Bloom is asked about the concert tour that Molly is going to take, because the tour organizer is, of course, Blazes Boylan. In Chapter 5, for instance, during a brief conversation with a man named McCoy, Bloom mentions that Molly is soon going to be singing at a swagger affair in the city of Belfast up north. "That's so," McCoy said. "Glad to hear it, old man. Who's getting it up?" The question could be wholly innocent. McCoy could simply be asking who is organizing the tour. But hearing this question through the ears of Bloom, which is what the novel makes us do, hearing this question through the ears of Bloom, we can't help feeling its sexual sting. Since you can't get it up, old man, who is? And if you look for an answer in this passage, you won't find one, because Bloom can't bear to answer this question straight. He can't bear to mention the name of Boylan. All he can do is to talk around it. It's a kind of tour, don't you see, Mr. Bloom said thoughtfully. There's a committee formed, part shares and part profits. But no names. Because the very name of Boylan, let alone the sight of him, simply intensifies in Bloom the pain of what he knows is coming later in the day when Molly will commit adultery. In Chapter 6, when Bloom is riding with several other men to the funeral of Paddy Dignam, one of the men catches sight of Blazes Boylan standing at the door of a pub, just as Bloom is thinking about Boylan's upcoming visit to Molly. But instead of looking up at Boylan, Bloom looks down at the nails of each hand, first right and then left, while thinking to himself, "Worst man in Dublin." What's fascinating about this moment is that Bloom is doing just the kind of thing that any one of us might do if we couldn't bear to look at something or someone. We've all done this with our nails, have we not? But the word nails will turn up again in Bloom's head, later in the chapter, during the funeral mass, when Bloom sees the letters I-N-R-I on the back of the priest's vestment. As every good Catholic schoolboy used to know, the letters actually stand for Jesus Nazarenus Rex Judaeorum, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, the words mockingly inscribed on the cross. But to Bloom, they mean Bloom's command of Catholic theology, indeed of Jewish tradition, not very firm. To bloom, the words, the letters I-N-R-I mean iron nails ran in. Okay. So when the very sight of Boylan makes him look at his nails, we are led to believe that he is silently and solitarily enduring a slow crucifixion. Given his suffering, much of the book prompts us to believe that Molly is chiefly responsible for it, for it is she who commits adultery, she who takes the lover on Bloom's Day. But the marriage of Leopold and Molly can never be reduced to the relation between victim and victimizer, or saint and villainess. To understand the marriage of Molly and Leopold, we must consider her just as carefully as we consider him. Today I want to get deep inside her monologue, her notorious monologue, if you will, which, by the way, scandalized even D.H. Lawrence, who would go on to write, imagine that, the sexually explicit story of Lady Chatterley's Lover. Nonetheless, he called Molly's monologue the dirtiest, most indecent, obscene thing ever written. Well, today I'm going to dig in that dirt, and my shovel, so to speak, is a late 18th century Irish poem that you probably never heard of, because I had never heard of it myself until I read about it in an essay by the late and resoundingly great Seamus Heaney, who was a wonderful critic, by the way, a wonderful critic as well as an extraordinary poet. The man responsible for this 18th century poem was an Irish schoolmaster named Brian Merriman, and the poem is called Midnight Court. Midnight Court is a story in verse, the story of a dream vision, in which a court of women, meeting at midnight and ruled by a fairy queen, find men guilty. Guilty not of assaulting women, as we might nowadays expect, but rather of neglecting women, above all of failing to gratify their sexual needs. For various reasons that I don't have time to talk about today, I'd be willing to bet that Joyce knew this poem, even though he never mentions it in Ulysses or anywhere else. But whether or not he actually knew this poem, its provocative defense of the sexual rights of women, including the right of a neglected wife to take a lover, strikingly anticipates the final chapter of Ulysses and furnishes a fascinating lens through which to read it. Let me say first a few more words about Midnight Court. Merriman begins his poem by telling how a bony, gigantic, and terrifying bailiff summons the poet himself to be judged by a court of women for his sins of sexual omission. As a bachelor of 31 who did not marry until 1797, the Irish are notorious for being bachelors and marrying late, as a bachelor of 31 who did not marry until 1797 when he was 48, Merriman knows all too well the charges that may be flung at him and his kind in 1780 when he wrote the poem. The oath has failed, declined, gone fallow. It's you and your spunkless generation. You're a source blocked off that won't refill. You have failed your women, one and all. In saying this, the bailiff of Merriman's poem anticipates the case against Bloom that is made in the final chapter of Ulysses, where in a way Bloom himself is put on trial by Molly. Though Bloom is hardly a childless bachelor like Merriman, he is roundly accused of failing to inseminate his wife and then of impotence in the Circe chapter. In one of the hallucinations of that chapter, Bloom imagines himself being auctioned off by Bella Cohen, the madam of a whorehouse in Dublin's red light district. Auctioning Bloom off as if he were a cow or a slave girl, Bella scornfully says, "What else are you good for, an impotent thing like you? Up, up, Manx cat. What have we here? Where's your curly teapot gone to, or who docked it on you, cocky Ollie? Sing, Bertie, sing. It's as limp as a boy of six is doing his pulley behind a cart. Buy a bucket or sell your pump. Can you do a man's job?" Bella Cohen thus scorns and ridicules Bloom for his impotence. Likewise, the author of The Midnight Court, who becomes a character in his own poem, is tried, humiliated, and punished for neglecting the sexual needs of Irish women. At the end of the poem, after the fairy president of the court has decreed whipping for all single males of 21 and over, a young single woman who has been testifying all along against spunkless men now delivers her particular verdict on the poet himself. "I hereby claim a woman's right to punish him. And you, dear women, must assist. So rope him, Una, and all the rest. Anna, Maura, take hold and bind him. Double twist his arms behind him. Let Mr. Bryan take what we give. Let him have it. Flay him alive, and don't draw back when you're drawing blood. Test all your whips against his manhood. Cut deep. No mercy. Make him squeal." This passage plainly anticipates the Circe chapter in Ulysses, where Bloom is put on trial. During the trial, three women charge that he urged them not only to misbehave, but also to, quote, give him a most vicious horsewhipping. And one of the women, Mrs. Talboys, actually threatens to flay him alive. Bloom is not a poet like Brian Merriman, and he is hardly being punished for his virginity. Subconsciously, he seeks whipping to gratify his masochistic needs, and Mrs. Talboys aims to punish him for the lewdness of his overtures to her. But when Bella later turns Bloom into a pig and makes him squeal, just as Brian Merriman will be made to squeal, she is clearly chastising him for his sexual inadequacy. So this chapter called Circe thus seems to furnish the clearest evidence of Merriman's influence on Ulysses. But no less striking is the way Molly's monologue recalls the lengthy speech of the young single woman in Merriman's poem, especially when she defends the sexual rights of a married woman. Quick sip. At one point, a fierce old man named Snarlygob springs up to denounce his wife for promiscuity and to accuse the young woman herself of selling her sexual favors. In response, the young woman retaliates with what Seamus Heaney calls an indignant and marvelously specific list of the old man's inadequacies as a lover and of his wife's attempts to overcome them. This speech wins the day, or rather the night. In the end, the queen of the court not only orders that bachelors of 21 and over be whipped, she also decrees, writes Seamus Heaney, that the worn-out, sexually incapable husbands of sexually vigorous women should connive in the action when their wives take younger lovers. Repeat. Should connive in the action when their wives take younger lovers. This is exactly what Bloom is made to do in Ulysses. When he masturbates in the chapter called Nausicaa, he proves that he is definitely not impotent. But connivance at his wife's adultery is precisely the punishment he inflicts on himself throughout Bloom's day, above all in Circe. There he becomes, in one of his trances, as we have seen, an antlered flunky greeting the very man who has come to cuckold him. Nevertheless, I don't want to argue that Joyce is simply reenacting the plot of Midnight Court any more than he is simply reenacting the plot of the Odyssey. When you compare Bloom with the lethargic bachelors and sexually negligent husbands denounced in Midnight Court, you have to see that Joyce offers a fundamentally different perspective on the breakdown of sexual relations within marriage. On one hand, Merriman makes us see neglected women, negligent males, and cuckolded husbands almost exclusively from the woman's point of view. On the other hand, Joyce thrusts us deep, no pun intended, Joyce thrusts us deep into the consciousness of the cuckolded and sexually negligent male before we enter the mind of his wife. By the time we come to Molly's monologue, we have come to know Bloom as far more sinned against than sinning. We have come to feel the pain he suffers as the father of a son who died in infancy, as the target of anti-Semitic contempt, and as the cruelly ridiculed husband of a woman widely known to be having an affair with Blazes Boylan. In the chapter called Cyclops, contempt and ridicule for Bloom's supposed impotence reinforce disdain for his Jewishness and his pacifism. In this chapter, Bloom for the first time openly identifies himself with a race that is hated and persecuted. But when he denounces injustice, even while rejecting force and hatred, the scornful narrator can see only an effeminate, lardy face twisting around as limp as a wet rag. "Do you call that a man?" asks the citizen later, to which another man replies, "I wonder did he ever put it out of sight." So, some of you know what that means. So, in the eyes of the citizen and his belligerently anti-Semitic pals, Bloom is nothing but a Jewish wimp. But in making anti-Semitism go hand in hand with contempt for Bloom's impotence, the novel draws our sympathy to him. Only through the myopic gaze of men like the citizen does Bloom seem a ridiculous cuckold. To us, he seems what he is called in the Sirens chapter, or at least to some of us he does, seems what he is called in the Sirens chapter, an unconquered hero of patience and pacifism, long-suffering victim of a grief that has indefinitely drained him not of potency, but of the urge to inseminate his wife, which is a very different thing. Why has he lost this urge? Why does he want to father no more children? On this Father's Day, which is also the eve of Bloom's Day, on this Father's Day, let us consider how he feels about his dead son, Rudy, the son who died just 11 days after he was born. In the funeral chapter, Bloom actually recalls the very moment at which Rudy was conceived. It comes to his mind just as he and several other men are on their way to the funeral of Patty Dignam. When they briefly catch sight of Stephen Dedalus, the son of Simon, Bloom can't help thinking about his own son, Rudy. But remarkably enough, Bloom thinks not about the death of this infant boy, but about his life and specifically the moment of his conception. Must have been, Bloom thinks, must have been that morning in Raymond Terrace. She was at the window watching two dogs at it outside and the sergeant grinning up. She had that cream gown on with the rip she never stitched. Give us a touch, Poldy. God, I'm dying for it. How life. Gives the touch, Poldy. God, I'm dying for it. How life begins. This is a startling passage, to say the least. One critic of Joyce, an Irish critic named Darcy O'Brien, in fact, charges that Bloom is unconsciously beating up on himself here. Not his own sexual allure, writes O'Brien, nor any love Molly might have had for him brought about the conception of Rudy. Two dogs at it, and the grin of a sergeant set Marion Bloom in motion. The incident is a typically Joycean view of the sexual act, bestial and obscene. Bloom's dwelling with evident pleasure on Rudy's bizarre conception compromises the pity one feels for him as a grieving father. So says Darcy O'Brien. But I think he's got it all wrong. In my humble opinion, O'Brien misses the point of the passage, misunderstands Bloom, and misunderstands Joyce. To be human, as Bloom resoundingly is to be profoundly conscious that we are embodied, that we are creatures of flesh and blood and instinct as well as of mind and spirit and morality. In the mind of Bloom, the fact that we have animal appetites for things like food and sex does not make us bestial. These appetites are inescapably part of what makes us human, and to deny them is to deny a vital part of ourselves. Why, Bloom might ask? Why should we be ashamed to copulate in something like the way that animals do? Why can we not admit that even within marriage, a perfectly healthy desire for sex may sometimes be sparked by hormones alone, or even Viagra, rather than by such lofty motives as love and admiration? If we always had to wait for love and admiration and idealization, how long would the human race last? Bloom is not self-deprecating here. He's frankly and unsqueamishly facing the fact that conception may spring from something totally unexpected, a sudden, irresistible impulse stirring the loins. Give us a touch, Poldy. God, I'm dying for it. How life begins. That's the bottom line of this passage, literally, how life begins. Bloom does not brood over Rudy's death. He celebrates in recollection the wonder of Rudy's birth. And even while riding to a burial, he mentally recreates a moment in which Molly's dying, her dying for sex, made life begin. And even though that life ended in just 11 days, Bloom still has a teenage daughter bursting with life as he goes on to reflect. Millie is away from home, working as a photographer's assistant in a town called Mullingar, where, as she explains in a letter to her dearest Papley, she has just met a young student who sings to her of seaside girls. Bloom knows where this may lead, but he doesn't for an instant regret it. Millie, Bloom thinks, her tomboy odes. Oh, jumping Jupiter, ye gods and little fishes. Still, she's a dear girl, soon be a woman. Mullingar, dearest Papley, young student. Yes, yes, a woman too. Life, life. Bloom is a champion of life. Nevertheless, in spite of his own vitality and his love of life, the death of little Rudy has killed his desire to beget any more life, to beget another child. About noon on Bloom's Day himself, he says to himself, could never like it again after Rudy. Meaning that ever since Rudy died over 10 years ago, he has been literally unable to have sexual intercourse with his wife, even though he is not otherwise impotent. This fact alone may help to explain the virulence of what Molly says to herself about Bloom's sexual habits, about all of the ways in which he stops short of sexually satisfying her. At the same time, she seems to know just how to exploit his peculiar sexual needs. If he wants to kiss my bottom, I'll drag open my drawers and bolt it right out in his face. As large as life, he can stick his tongue 7 miles up my hole as he's there, my brown part. Then I'll tell him I want a pound or perhaps 30 shillings. I'll tell him I want to buy underclothes, and if he gives me that, well, he won't be so bad. Apparently bent on humiliating Bloom as well as exploiting him, Molly wants him to know that Boylan has bettered her. I'll let him know if that's what he wanted, that his wife is fucked, yes, and damn well fucked too, up to my neck nearly, not by him. 5 or 6 times hand-running, there's the mark of his spunk on the clean sheet. I wouldn't bother even to iron it out. That ought to satisfy him, if you don't believe me, feel my belly, unless I made him stand there and put him into me. I've a mind to tell him every scrap and made him do it all out in front of me. Serve him right. It's all his own fault if I'm an adulteress. It's a thing in the gallery set. Here, Molly sounds not just obscene, but ruthless. She seems heartlessly bent on crushing a man already abused, unappreciated, and exhausted by the pressures of his day. A man who has already borne far more than his share of indifference and contempt from nearly everyone he has met. Yet to see Molly as a merry manic heroine is to see that in spite of all Bloom has endured from others, we cannot ignore what she has endured from him, what justification she has for adultery after more than 10 years of no complete sexual intercourse at all. Knowing full well that Bloom can ejaculate, rightly guessing that he came somewhere on Bloom's day itself, and knowing, too, that he typically ejaculates on her own backside, Molly cannot understand his prolonged abstention from complete sexual intercourse with her. She cannot fathom what has been called his secondary impotence, which is the inability to complete sexual intercourse for reasons of anxiety or trauma, the official definition, in this case from the trauma precipitated by the death of Rudy. Consequently, she cannot understand why she has been sexually deserted for so long. What else were we given all those desires for, I'd like to know. I can't help it if I'm young still, can I? It's a wonder I'm not an old shriveled hag before my time, living with him so cold, never embracing me except sometimes when he's asleep the wrong end of me, not knowing, I suppose, who he has. Any man that'd kiss a woman's bottom, I'd throw my hat at him. After that, he'd kiss anything unnatural, where we haven't one atom of any kind of expression in us, all of the same 2 lumps of lard. Bloom loves kissing Molly's bottom, the plump, mellow, yellow, smellow melons off her rump, for the same reason that he loves sucking on her breasts, as he did at least once, as Molly recalls, like some kind of big infant when she was weaning Millie and needed mammary relief. Above or below, he loves losing himself in her soft, round, maternal warmth. But if Bloom can play the infant to Molly's indulgent mothering, he can also mother her. One of the very first things he does in the novel, as I've already noted, is to bring Molly her breakfast in bed, including the cream especially reserved for her. Molly craves this kind of mothering because she has never had a mother of her own, a point whose importance cannot be overstated. Never had a mother of her own. She is the daughter of her father's Spanish mistress on the island of Gibraltar. And she never knew more of Lenita Laredo than her name and her Jewish ethnicity. Nor has Molly ever found any other woman who could serve as a mother surrogate. Consequently, as one critic has argued, Molly takes Bloom not only as her husband and lover, but also, unconsciously, as her true mother surrogate. But he can't be just a mother surrogate. He must also be her lover. The man Molly needs must be both her mother and her lover, and that's what Bloom once was, a man who gratified all of her needs. At the rapturous end of her monologue, what she remembers is a moment of lovemaking so intense that it gratified both of her urges at once, infantile and sexual, with the line between the two virtually erased. Yet for more than 10 years, Bloom has incomprehensibly failed to satisfy her sexual needs and has thus reenacted, again and again, her mother's abandonment of her in infancy. To see that this ineradicable memory of pre-Oedipal desertion underlies her present yearning for Bloom is to see why she lacerates him in her monologue and also why her complaint swerves so sharply from what it evokes, the second speech of the young woman in Merriman's poem and behind it the medieval song of the unhappy wife. Take, for instance, Molly's view of childbearing. The young woman of Merriman's poem wants to have children and wants to see Irish birth rates rise. Molly herself, just before her monologue, assumes the pose of the earth mother Gaia Tellus, fulfilled, recumbent, big with seed. But unlike Merriman's young woman, she has no desire for another child and is clearly relieved when she menstruates, because this clearly shows that Boylan didn't make her pregnant. Also, while Merriman's bailiff castigates the poet's spunkless generation for the fall in birth rates, Molly deplores just the opposite, the relentlessly fecundating energy of the husband of Mina Purefoy, who has yet another child, bears yet another child on Bloomsday night. Molly says, "And Mina Purefoy's husband, filling her up with a child of twins once a year as regular as the clock, always with a smell of children on her, off her." This is hardly the voice of a woman who wants to have more children. Molly's critique of fecundity could be read as evidence that she is an up-to-date feminist version of Merriman's heroine, a woman who declines to play the archetypal role of the earth mother or define herself in terms of her reproductive functions. She can also speak of male genitalia with a fine irreverence. "What a man looks like with his two bags full and his other thing hanging down out of him and sticking up at you like a hat rack. No wonder they hide it with a cabbage leaf." In general, as one critic notes, she asserts the physical and moral superiority of women, and even in her most outspoken attack on the behavior of her own sex, she explains it as due to all that women have to put up with. Nevertheless, close study of her most explicitly feminist language reveals a black hole, please, no pun intended, a black hole in Molly's brief for womankind. Even as she imagines something like Merriman's court of women, she lets us see how treacherous they can be. "I don't care what anybody says. It'd be much better for the world to be governed by the women in it. You wouldn't see women going and killing one another and slaughtering. When do you ever see women rolling around drunk like they do, or gambling every penny they have and losing it on horses?" "Yes, because a woman, whatever she does, knows where to stop," says Molly in the middle of her nonstop monologue. "A woman, whatever she does, knows where to stop. Sure, they wouldn't be in the world at all, only for us. They don't know what it is to be a woman and a mother. How could they? Where would they all of them be if they hadn't a mother to look after them? What I never had. What I never had." It's risky to claim that any part of Molly's monologue has a beginning and an end, but I would venture to bet that the ending of this passage detonates, or at the very least deconstructs, its beginning. After first proclaiming the moral superiority of women, Molly ends by recalling that she was abandoned by her own mother. "Where would they all be if they hadn't a mother to look after them?" she asks. Molly herself personifies the answer to this question, which turns out to be more than rhetorical. Motherless from birth, nursing for life a sense of betrayal, she lives in a state of irremediable bitterness against all other women. While often called subversive, she is nowhere more so than in rejecting at least two fundamental tenets of what might be called mainstream feminism: faith in the sisterhood of women and in their openness to any other woman's voice. Is any other woman really open to Molly's voice? According to one critic, Molly's ideal listener is a, quote, "a woman with whom she can share her restlessness, her physical desires, her fantasies, her cynical views of men, as well as her realistic views of motherhood and menstruation that don't come from the dominant discourses of society," unquote. But among the women she knows, where does Molly find a sympathetic ear? Where does she identify her kindred spirit as female? Just a few lines after envisioning the peace and order of a world run by women, she tells herself that men, quote, "men have friends they can talk to, we've none. Either he wants what he won't get, or it's some woman ready to stick her knife in you. I hate that in women. No wonder they treat us the way they do. We are a dreadful lot of bitches. I suppose it's all the troubles we have that make us so snappy. I'm not like that." Molly's critique of women as bitches can indeed be read as part of an appeal for sympathy on their behalf, in view of all the troubles that make them bitch, as Molly is even now doing. Yet no sooner does Molly indict we women for bitchiness, however excusable, than she exempts herself from their company. "I'm not like that." Is this really one oppressed sister talking to another? The we-they opposition may imply that Molly is addressing another woman, but if we've not a single friend, we disintegrates, then in any case, this is hardly the voice of a woman seeking common cause with other women against the male oppressor. Instead of distrusting men, the unmothered Molly distrusts all women. Ever since Hester Stanhope left her behind in Gibraltar to nearly die of boredom, she has never had a single female friend, and she sees almost every other woman as a rival for male attention, an object of contempt, or at best an object of pity. Hester Stanhope, incidentally, or not so incidentally, was the young wife of a British officer who developed a crush on young Molly, which is probably one reason why his wife urged him and them to depart for to leave Gibraltar. So there wasn't an open rift between Molly and Hester Stanhope, but there is definitely a suggestion of rivalry. And in a subtle or not so subtle sense, Hester's departure from Gibraltar reenacts Juanita Laredo's abandonment of the infant Molly. This is an old story for Molly. Just as problematic is Molly's relation to her own daughter, her only surviving child. Molly remembers caring for Millie once when she was down with the mumps, but Molly now resents her for her impudence and her nascent sex appeal, which has begun to make Molly feel finished and supplanted in the eyes of Bloom. In the question and answer catechism of the chapter known as Ithaca, the catechism chapter, we are led to believe that Millie's first bleeding has forged a bond of sympathy between mother and daughter, a pre-established natural comprehension in incomprehension, in the heavy language of the catechism. And a critic named Suzette Henke sees a newfound emotional communion between them. But Molly has little more than spite for her daughter. Nothing she thinks or feels about Millie can match Bloom's heartfelt memory of her menarche, her growing pains at night, calling, wakening me. Frightened she was when her nature came on her first. Poor child. Strange moment for the mother, too. Brings back her own girlhood. But to what end? Molly can see that Millie is reliving her mother's youth, including her sexy exhibitionism. But she has no sympathy for a girl who simply reminds her that her own girlhood is gone, irretrievably. Gone, too, is the capacity to love any child at all. The death of little Rudy, she reveals, disheartened her altogether and left her feeling that I'd never have another. Our first death, too, we were never the same since. But if the pain of her loss suggests that she once felt maternal love for Rudy, she feels it no more. The closest she comes is a stirring of paternal sympathy for Stephen. I suppose he's running wild now, out at night away from his books and studies, and not living at home on account of the usual rowy house, I suppose. Well, it's a poor case that those that have a fine son like that are not satisfied, and I none. Was he not able to make one? It wasn't my fault. Suzette Henke argues that in Molly's fantasies, Stephen first of all takes the place of Bloom as a potential lover, and then awakens her maternal longing. Like Bloom, writes Henke, Molly desperately longs for a surrogate son to replace little Rudy, and like her husband, she mentally adopts Stephen and imagines him as a full-fledged member of the household. But Molly cannot sustain the role of Stephen's mother. Whatever she may feel of maternal solicitude, it is soon trumped by lust. Take the passage in which she worries that Stephen might be ruining himself for life in the company of nightwalkers and pickpockets. Here she thinks just like a mother, except when she goes on to speculate on why he might have declined to sleep on the Bloom sofa. He was shy as a boy, she says. He was shy as a boy, he being so young, hardly 20. Shy of me in the next room, he'd have heard me on the chamber pot. Ah, rah, what harm. In Molly's scenario, a boyish Stephen who is shy of Molly's seductive powers plays a reluctant young Shakespeare to her shameless Anne Hathaway, alluding to the Shakespeare chapter here. But obviously Molly plans to overcome Stephen's shyness, as when she plots their courses of mutual instruction. I can tell him the Spanish, and he can tell me the Italian. When she's teaching him Spanish and learning Italian from him, she also imagines that he'll see I'm not so ignorant, which is exactly what she wanted him to see earlier when she cast him as her lover. I'll read and study all I can find or learn a bit off by heart so he won't think me stupid. And I can teach him the other part. I'll make him feel all over him till he half faints under me. Then he'll write a bit about me, lover and mistress, publicly too, with our two photographs in all the papers when he becomes famous. On top of all this, Molly plans to feed Stephen breakfast in bed every day, and thus to make him what Henke calls a pampered guest. Given that fact, can we be sure that her motives end up strictly maternal, or that they are genuinely maternal at all? How many mothers, no matter how maternal, regularly serve their healthy grown-up children breakfast in bed? A fairly safe answer is none. Molly's stirrings of paternal solicitude are overwhelmed by her desire for sexual satisfaction, which springs in part, as Henke says, from her pre-Oedipal need to be mothered. It is precisely this need that goads her to rail at Bloom when he fails to satisfy it. He is the good mother whose peculiar kind of unresponsiveness makes him look bad to an emotionally voracious child. Yet for all her resentment of Bloom, Maliot is mature enough, this is really quite interesting, to recognize that he is her best friend. All of the qualities that she ascribes to women at their best, sobriety, good money management, self-restraint, peacemaking, and even mothering, all of these things can be found in Bloom, who is, among many other things, a tenderly solicitous parent, and who actually says in Circe that he yearns to be a mother. Molly herself salutes his sense of responsibility. In a city filled with drunken good-for-nothings, she appreciates his thriftiness and concern for his family. She also likes his general politeness, his habitual good manners, such as wiping his feet and tipping his hat, and his consideration for her sleep. By contrast, Boylan is a boorish oaf, not much more than a walking dildo. Listen carefully to Molly's final comment on his visit. No, that's no way for him. Has he no manners, no refinement? No, nothing in his nature. Slapping us behind like that on my bottom because I didn't call him Hugh, the ignoramus that doesn't know poetry from a cabbage. That's what you get for not keeping them in their proper place. Pulling off his shoes and trousers there on the chair before me, so barefaced, without even asking permission, and standing out of that vulgar way in the half of a shirt they wear to be abided like a priest or a butcher. Sure, you might as well be in bed with what? With a lion. As you all know, Molly's monologue ends with a resounding series of yeses, right up to its very last word, yes. But here, the key word is no. Launching the final long section of the chapter, the hammer beats of no, 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 in the opening line of this passage accentuate, by contrast, the resounding repetition of yes at the end, where Molly remembers the unforgettable day on which she declared her desire for Bloom. Earlier, she sounds desperate to see Boylan again. Oh, Lord, I can't wait till Monday. Yet in the end, Molly's words for Boylan and Bloom are respectively no and yes. In Molly's eyes, Bloom is not just more refined than Boylan, he is somehow more potent. Even while celebrating Boylan's capacity to come with ever-growing frequency, 3 or 4 times, 4 or 5 times, 5 or 6 times, Molly insists that Poldy has more spunk in him. Here again, she differs fundamentally from Merriman's young woman, whose opinion of Irish bachelors and husbands is relentlessly negative. For what Molly finally wants is not to castigate or punish Bloom for neglecting her, but to win him back. That alone underscores the point that Molly's autobiography is chiefly the story of her relation to a succession of men. Her father, Lieutenant Jack Joe Harry Mulvey, can't remember the first name, Lieutenant Stanley G. Gardner, Leopold Bloom, and Blazes Boylan. If a continuing quest for sexual satisfaction is conventional, Molly is conventional, as a critic named Elaine Unkelis has argued. But she is not at all conventional in the audacity and self-possession with which she manages her lovers. At 15, she knew exactly how to rouse her first lover and pull him off into her handkerchief without revealing her own excitement or letting him touch her inside her petticoat. At present, even after more than 10 years of sexual neglect, she will take all possible steps to revive Bloom's desire for her. I'll give him just one more chance. I'll get up early in the morning. I know what I'll do. I'll go about rather gay and not too much, singing a bit now and then. Mi fa pietà mazzetto. Then I'll start dressing myself to go out. Presto, non son più forte. Then I'll put on my best shift and drawers. Let him have a good eyeful out of that to make his Mickey stand for him. I'll let him do it off on me behind, provided he doesn't smear all my good drawers. Oh, I suppose that can't be helped. Then I'll wipe him off me just like a business, his omission. Then I'll go out. I'll have him eyeing up at the ceiling. Where is she gone now? Make him want me. That's the only way. Make him want me. That's the only way. Molly's urge to punish and humiliate Bloom cannot finally be split from her desire for him, or rather from her will to rouse his desire for her. Just as Merriman's young woman dresses up to attract male attention, Molly will don her best shift and drawers to make Bloom's Mickey stand. She will then let him ejaculate on her buttocks and wipe off his omission as if it were a business, so much shit. Molly has already misspelled or mispronounced emissions in recalling the doctor who asked if she had frequent omissions. But the slip is telling, for Bloom's emissions have indeed missed or omitted Molly, who will now retaliate by making Bloom miss her in a different sense, feel her absence when she goes out, want her. The phrases she plans to sing from Don Giovanni bristle with ambiguity, suggesting at once her surrender to Boylan and her attachment to Bloom. The phrases come from Zerlina's duet with the Don Giovanni, La Ci Darem La Mano, which Molly will sing in the concert tour that Boylan is promoting. And that's the duet in which Don Giovanni effectively seduces, or at least distracts Zerlina, who is engaged to this man, Mazzetto. He persuades her to come up to his house there, he says in the song, I will take your hand, and so forth. On the surface, Zerlina's words imply surrender to the Don and betrayal of her fiancé, Mazzetto. But in fact, Zerlina resists the seductive power of the Don and returns to Mazzetto. Molly puts her own twist on this scenario. Not at all seduced by Boylan, whose boorishness repels her, she takes him as a lover in order to precipitate Bloom's full return to her. Though all Dublin seems to know of her affair, adultery is an act that she performs for Bloom as her only audience. Carol Schloss has recently argued that Irish marriage in 1904 was very much like the Unionist subjugation of Ireland, in which England used material aid to buy off nationalist aspirations and perpetuate its own rule. As a married woman in the Ireland of 1904, Molly had very few rights. She could not vote, she could not get a separation order, she could not gain custody of Millie if divorce were possible, she could not keep the money she made from her concerts, she could not invest money or hold property in her name. How then can she express her resistance to the marriage union? Carol Schloss writes, she can withhold consent, she can complain, and she can engage in acts of subterfuge that undermine the structures of authority that bind her to life. She does all three, unquote. But does she? In fact, aside from complaining about Bloom, sometimes bitterly, how does she withhold consent? Her monologue opens by mentioning an unprecedented request that Bloom has made for breakfast in bed, but by the end of the monologue, it is evident that she will comply, however grudgingly. Then I'll throw him up his eggs and tea, she says. If Bloom's habitual practice of serving her in the morning has up to now undermined the structures of patriarchal authority in the Bloom household, does her willingness to serve him on the morning after Bloom's day reinstate those structures or exemplify the spirit of reciprocity that animates their love at its most intense? And is her affair with Boylan a speech act against marriage, a refusal of its bonds, as Schloss says? Or is it a daring way of eliciting Bloom's consent to her, since he has long denied her the chance to withhold her consent from him? The problem with reading their marriage as an allegory of Ireland's demeaning union with England is that for all Bloom's failings, Molly has no desire for complete autonomy. She has no wish to leave the only man she has ever known who understood, as she says, who understood or felt what a woman is. To read Penelope through the lens of Midnight Court is to see more clearly what Molly wants. Merriman's outspoken young woman attacks the men of 18th century Ireland to overthrow not so much their authority as their complacency, to rouse them from their spunkless lethargy, to goad them into marriage, sexual vitality, and fatherhood. Molly attacks Bloom to rouse him, to reanimate the man she married 16 years ago, to recover the mother surrogate who once gratified both her pre-edipal needs and her sexual desires, to reactivate the lover who has long been returning each night to her bed, but not to the depths of her body. In Penelope, Molly testifies against the very man she yearns to win back. In a lecture called Risky Reading of Risky Writing, given at the annual James Joyce Symposium of 2002, the great Joyce scholar Margot Norris provocatively argued that Molly's early, powerful, vividly remembered intimacy with Hester Stanhope could well imply lesbian tendencies. After Margot's lecture, a young Czech scholar reminded me that Molly at one point thinks, quote, she wouldn't mind being a man and getting up on a lovely woman, unquote. So we have good reason to believe that Molly is bisexual, which is one of the many reasons for which she loves Bloom. As Molly herself knows, says, Bloom knows, or at the very least once knew, what a woman is. He is woman enough as well as man enough for her, if only he can bring himself to give her again what she so desperately wants. Okay. What is my final answer to the question raised by my title? Can this marriage be saved? Let me edge up to an answer by briefly comparing the ending of Ulysses with the ending of a quite different novel by another man named James, Henry James, Portrait of a Lady, published 40 years earlier than Ulysses, just about the time Joyce was born. By the end of James's novel, Elizabeth Archer has come to hate the man she married, the man she freely married, because his tyrannical egotism threatens to suffocate her. But in defiance of all sentiment, she spurns the love of the bold American businessman who has all along been yearning to rescue her and decides to go back to her husband, a decision that superficially saves her marriage, but also dooms her, it seems, to the marital equivalent of Cold War. The ending of Ulysses is nothing like this. On the contrary, it ends with Molly's passionate recollection of the moment when Bloom asked her to be his wife. Then I asked him with my eyes to ask again, yes. And then he asked me, would I, yes, to say yes, my mountain flower. And first I put my arms around him, yes, and drew him down to me so he could feel my breast all perfume. And his heart was going like mad, and yes, I said, yes, I will, yes. What does this passionate affirmation mean now, 16 years after she made it? Like Henry James, James Joyce declines to end his novel on a note of certitude, declines to give a straightforward answer, because neither marriage nor life itself, for that matter, offers any certainty beyond the inevitability of death. Molly's monologue, I believe, plainly reveals that her love for Bloom is certainly not dead, that within her still burns at least a spark of the fire she felt when he asked her to marry him. But I will not presume to say exactly what that yes means for the salvation of their marriage. I will simply end with what Joyce himself said about the whole of Molly's monologue. It begins and ends with the female word yes. It turns like the huge earth ball slowly, surely, evenly, round and round spinning. Though probably more obscene than any preceding episode, it seems to me perfectly sane, full, amoral, fertilizable, untrustworthy, engaging, shrewd, limited, prudent, indifferent, vile woman. Ich bin der Fleisch, der stets bejaht. I am the flesh that always says yes. And it's amazing that Joyce should have turned flesh into a masculine noun, but there it is. Not even Joyce was infallible.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I guess we have some questions. Yes. Ah, here he is. Adam, I want to introduce you all to Adam Harvey. If you don't know him, you should. He is the greatest performer of Finnegan's Wake on the planet. I've heard him many times. He has memorized huge sections of Finnegan's Wake, and he recites it with terrific brio, and I hope that at some point, maybe even here at the Lannan Foundation, you will have the pleasure of hearing him. So, your question. Okay, yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
But I guess what leaves me curious about, yeah, is especially with Ulysses, is this issue of the stylistic acrobatics, uh-huh, that Joyce performs,
right,
in the book,
right,
and whether or not one can argue, and it's been done so often,
uh-huh,
that Ulysses and Joyce with Ulysses,
yeah,
is simply showing off.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know whether or not I can defend, mm-hmm, us Joyceans against, or Joyce against that charge, except, uh-huh, to say something in that's in his stylistic, mm-hmm, adventures, mm-hmm, adds to the depth of the characters that he's,
yeah,
that he's portraying.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if,
yeah,
there's something you might be able to add to
there's
that.
No question. Issue. There's a great deal of pyrotechnics in Ulysses, and in certain chapters. If you just think about chapter 14, for instance, Oxen of the Sun. When Minna Purefoy's baby is being born, and he narrates that event in a sequence of styles that sort of begin with, I think it's something out of the Book of Genesis, and moves through this heavily Latinate version of English, and about eight or nine other styles, you know, coming up to, I mean, that is exhibitionism. That is stylistic exhibitionism, no question about it. On the other hand, as we noted in the passage, some of the passages I quoted today, Joyce can do extraordinary things with very short, simple words. Give me a touch, Poldy, I'm dying for it, God, how lucky. When it comes to, you know, certain points, when he wants to deliver the goods, when he wants to hit you in the solar plexus, he can do it. So, yes, he's guilty of exhibitionism, but I think ultimately, for those of us who know and really love this book, what he does elsewhere more than compensates for, you know, that defect, if it is a defect of this book, I think. That's what I would argue.
But
yes?
It's so bad, if he's himself
sorry? No.
If he's delivered the goods elsewhere.
No, I, and you know, after all, in the first chapter, Mulligan's a show-off. And Mulligan is, you know, for many of us, a rather charming character. You know, singing the song of the Ballad of the Joking Jesus and all of that. He has this, the exhibitionism of, you know, might be called collegiate exhibitionism. Playing with words, playing games. And you say, well, it's irrelevant. Come on, this is a serious story about Stephen. He just lost his mother. He's mourning for his mother. But, you know, if you have a choice between talking to a guy who's in mourning for his mother and talking to Mulligan and singing all these wonderful songs, you know which way you're going to go. You go to the life of the party, right? And I think there's a little bit of that kind of competition even in within the novel itself. Joyce is a writer who apparently can do absolutely anything. You know, so maybe he doesn't always resist the temptation to show off. But it's part of what makes his novel fun. And as my wife reminded me only this morning, let's not forget that Ulysses is finally a comedy. Right? It's a comedy. Yes?
No, I was thinking that maybe...
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, sure. Thank you.
Okay. Your talk was excellent. We were rapt, maybe more than one way. And I agree with the gentleman who said maybe the showing off is okay. It's like seeing a really gorgeous guy or maybe a gorgeous woman, and if he or she can also recite some fabulous poetry, it's okay if they're gorgeous as well.
You can forgive them for that, yeah, right.
And everybody, I think almost everybody in this novel is a show-off, except... Mr. Bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we come to love him because the side of us that doesn't love to show off, that would like to be seen, we'd like to be understood without having to show off, is rewarded.
Mm-hmm.
And Molly comes around to that. She says, after all, I really want to be understood.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Right. Oh, absolutely. Understood by that's right. I have my lovely. But you know, it's interesting. You're right. Bloom is not a show off, and he's very understated. He's very modest, which is why it is so astonishing, I think, for most of us when you get to the chapter 13, Nausicaa chapter, to have Gertie McDowell reading him as a matinee. I said, this guy who you probably pictured in your mind sort of dumpy and, you know, unattractive or at least hardly glamorous, and all of a sudden he's a matinee. Holy cow. You know? But the other point about his being not flashy is true, though it's interesting that in the first Bloom chapter, when he comes to Molly's bedroom, she's reading a smutty novel, as it happens, and she comes to the word, a word she doesn't recognize. And can't even pronounce. And she hands, she's got a sort of buttery finger. She's been having butter and toast and so forth. She points to the word in the text. She says, what does that mean? And Bloom says, reincarnation. And she says, well, what does that mean? And he says, well, it's from the Greek. It's transmigration of souls. Oh, rocks, tell us in plain words, says Molly. I want to hear the big word. The point is that, you know, Bloom has some aspirations to intellectual distinction. You know, he reads Shakespeare, he reads other things, he has intellectual curiosity, but he's not a show-off. And she asked him to explain the word. And, of course, the wonderful thing about that little exchange is that it highlights subtly, but in a way perhaps explicitly, the fact that Bloom is now reincarnating the life of Odysseus. He has no idea that he's doing any such thing, right? But that's what's going on. he is reincarnating the life of Odysseus.
I think he said Odysseus, but they're the same person.
Yes, over here? Yeah, sorry. Yeah, go ahead. When? Well, this is a very interesting question. Yeah, how does a novel like this get recognized? The reviews at first were very mixed. There was an absolutely brilliant review by Gilbert Selders, now perhaps forgotten, or his daughter, Marion Selders, some of you may remember. I think she died recently. I forget exactly where, in some journal, might have been The Nation or something, in August of 1922, and so this is only, it's published in February 1st, Joyce's 40th birthday, 1922. In August appears this review. Now imagine being asked to review Ulysses. he and others who really were following Joyce had a bit of a head start, because chapters of the novel began to appear in, I believe, 1918 in the Little Review, which was funded by Harriet Weaver, a very generous supporter of Joyce. Something like 7 or 8 chapters appeared in the Little Review. Virginia Woolf was one of them, one who read them. So he might have gotten a head start that way. But the point is that he publishes an absolutely amazing review, along with the comment that T.S. Eliot makes a full year later, when he says, this is the most extraordinary work of the present age. It is a work none of us can escape. And he was absolutely right. Nobody was interested in literature could possibly escape the influence of Ulysses. So you have some very powerful statements early on. But it still takes, first of all, it takes a long time to get published in, legally admissible to the United States in 1934 with the Wolsey decision, the Random House edition. And then a while after that for it to establish itself as simply a major piece of work. There's something similar that happens in visual art as well, how reputations get established, what it takes to make a reputation. It's a fascinating subject. In fact, it would be a great subject for a book. I'm sure there's a book on it, but there would be more than one book on it, not just how this particular book gets canonized, but how other books get canonized. The Academy, of course, plays its part. And Ireland itself, the reception of Joyce in Ireland has just turned 180 degrees. I mean, it used to be that you would be vilified. I think one of the nieces of Joyce, had a hard time even finding a husband because she was thought to be associated with that man who wrote the obscene book. But now, Joyce is absolutely embraced. There are Bloomsday celebrations in Ireland, and several of us here went to the one in 2004. Joyce, there's a statue of Joyce, a wonderful statue of Joyce seated just off O'Connell Street, and so on and so forth. I mean, they have finally embraced and recognized him as a giant of their culture. Yeah.
I read a commentary recently that remarked that Ulysses in particular changed the face of the novel mm-hmm. for the 20th century. I'm wondering if you could remark about that and how so.
Well, you talk about specific influences. I'm trying to think of the name of the Irish novelist who wrote the novel At Swim, Two Boys. Some of you may know that. You can help me. I'm just not getting the name of the novelist.
O'Brien,
thank you very much. There are passages in that could not possibly have been written without the model of Ulysses in mind. It's harder, I think, and especially off the top of my head like this, to say in more general terms what the impact has been, because obviously nobody's going to come anywhere near repeating the achievement of Ulysses. Nobody's going to attempt the kind of stylistic, the variety of styles that he has in that novel. Certainly he has, demonstrated, this is a landmark case of stream of consciousness, which you also find in Virginia Woolf, and the whole case of Joyce's influence on Virginia Woolf is an absolutely fascinating topic. I've written an article about that, which I think is accessible online, as a matter of fact, because Virginia Woolf felt profoundly ambivalent about Ulysses. Scornful, she actually described herself, in fact, revolted by its, what she called its indecency, but nonetheless powerfully impressed by the way in which it represented the workings of an individual mind. And doing Joyce, she recognized that Joyce was doing exactly what she had been trying to do in her own work. And in a conversation with T.S. Eliot, she said, in effect, she was feeling rather down, you know, that Joyce had beaten her to the punch. Although she doesn't admit this elsewhere, that she is so ambivalent about him, I mean, right up to the very end. And even the claim, she finally says, you know, I finished Ulysses, she says to her diary, and I call it a misfire. Well, I have argued, and I think on the basis of very good evidence, that she could not possibly have finished that novel. She stopped at page 200, and that was it. She hated, she was pushing herself through it and just couldn't bear to finish the rest of it. So I think she lied, actually, at saying that she had finished it, and it's a misfire. So, but then she, you know, the fascinating thing, Ulysses appears in 1922, and we get, in 1925, we get Mrs. Dalloway. Well, it happens to be the story of a woman who lives in Dublin, and in the middle of June, she spends the day wandering around Dublin, thinking quite a lot about her past. Gee, that sounds a little bit familiar somehow. Which is, again, not to say Virginia Woolf is aping James Joyce. I would never say that. It's simply that I think that novel demonstrates exactly what Eliot said. We will never escape his influence. This is a novel that nobody can escape. Yes, Adam?
And it seems to me that if you want to look for influence, there's so many writers, even today, like Roddy Doyle, says Ulysses needs a good editor. You know, how come he didn't have a good editor? Yeah. So that there's still a resentment among writers, but I wonder whether or not the influence really didn't carry over to other media. Uh-huh. I think a particular film
is
all over the place.
Yeah,
I'm not certain there would be such a thing as a Terry Gilliam
absolutely. Yeah.
Without Joyce and that amazing experiment I did. Yeah.
And not incidentally, of course, Joyce himself was extremely interested in film, tried to start a movie theater in Dublin. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it failed. And just, you know, the timing was off. But yes, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Support me a little bit in sharing with the audience that this novel is accessible and shouldn't be shied away from, shouldn't be intimidated by some of the comments that are made today.
Okay. No, that's another excellent question, and I was asked a similar question a couple of weeks ago. I gave a talk at Georgetown, and I was asked, is this a hospitable novel? And I didn't immediately understand the question, and he meant exactly what you're talking about. Is it accessible? There are parts of it that are, well, you can say this. The whole novel is studded with allusions that, for most of us, have to be explained. There is, fortunately, a book by Don Gifford called Annotations to Ulysses, which explains, you know, almost all of those allusions. You take, for example, Stephen thinking about Mulligan when he's leaving the Martello Tower early in the morning, and he says to himself about the key to the tower, which apparently Stephen has. He says to himself, Stephen says to himself, he wants that key. It is mine. I paid the rent. Now I eat his salt bread. I have hardly time to explain everything that's going on here, but Now I Eat His Salt Bread is an allusion to Dante in the Paradiso, when he discovers that he's going to be exiled from Florence and will be forced to live on the hospitality of another and to eat salty bread, which Florentines didn't like, because he's not in Florence anymore. He is living with somebody else. In other words, Now I Eat His Salt Bread means now I eat the bitter bread of dependency. Okay. So here is Stephen. He has to give up the key to Mulligan. He knows Mulligan is the host of this tower, and that he is Mulligan's guest, Mulligan's dependent. That's just one example. I mean, you have to go back into Dante and understand the story of his relation to his ancestor who predicts what's going to happen to him and so forth. One of many examples, studded with these allusions. But, on the other hand, there are certain passages, as I think we saw today, Give us a touch, Poldy. I'm dying for it. Go out of our life again. You don't need Gifford to understand what's going on there. Or Mr. Leopold Bloom ate with relish the inner organs of beasts and fowls. Anybody got a problem with that? I actually suggest, or I've suggested, that if you're a little fearful of getting overwhelmed by the encyclopedic knowledge of Joyce and the number of allusions, that you actually start with the first Bloom chapter 4, which is, I think, really pretty accessible. It's Bloom, making his breakfast and getting out to buy the pork kidney for his breakfast and coming back and talking to Molly and so on and so forth. It's not too daunting. I wouldn't recommend starting with chapter 3, Proteus, ineluctable modality of the visible, at least that, if no more, thought through my eyes. Oh my God, Aristotle, metaphysics. No, you don't want that right away. You want to start with Bloom. Hemingway, interestingly, said, a comment that I love, that when he first started reading Ulysses, he just said, Joyce has written a goddamn wonderful book. Loved Bloom, hated Stephen. Because you see, Bloom has this language, the pithiness of his language, and the humanity. You feel the flesh and blood of Bloom in that language. Stephen, especially in the early chapters, he's remote, he's aloof, he's intellectual, he's abstruse. There are just ways of getting into Ulysses. It is a terrifically demanding novel, which I think repays the work that it demands of the reader.
Could just add to that, even the difficult passages wind up being tremendously rewarding if mm-hmm. you're willing to put the work into mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. The idea that there's a work of art that's actually challenging you, and obviously this is a Finnegan's Wakeian talking here.
Oh,
the point is that this information, now that this, what's it called again? The internet is there. This stuff is a click away. The information and the knowledge, right. It's all been compiled. It's
right.
sitting there waiting
right.
for you to take it in. It's not
has
like
Gifford
it used
been put
to
online,
be.
Adam?
Huh?
Has Gifford been put online, do you know?
Yeah, I don't think Gifford has. There have been some attempts made. I know Mike Groden has any number of times tried to put it up. But Finnegan's Wake, there is a fantastic annotations website. Absolutely
right.
Flawless.
Yeah.
It's just comprehensive and marvelous.
That's
called fweet.org. It's this fellow in Tel Aviv that just sat down and typed it all in.
Terrific.
It's amazing.
Good. Yes.
I wanted to say that what helped me with Ulysses was being in the reading group at the library, and I think it's so much fun to do it with a group of people.
I completely agree. Yeah.
And I actually think that's the best way to do it.
I had the great pleasure of meeting with Adam and several other people yesterday in the reading group, looking through portions of the Aeolus chapter. Yeah, it's great. Absolutely. Yes. Yes, it does. It does. I said that. I said place in London. But the point of connection is that you have Bloom wandering around Dublin. You have Mrs. Dalloway wandering around London. Mea culpa. London. Thank you. Sorry. A slip. Freudian slip, whatever. Yeah.
I just want to make a comment. The very first time I read Joyce, I luckily didn't know that I wasn't supposed to like it. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand it. I was something like 16, mm-hmm. and I didn't get the naughty bits because I grew up in Boston. But what
yes, my native city.
All right. Oh, really? I grew up in Cambridge. Well, anyway, the way I read it was I just read the parts I liked. I skimmed the parts I didn't understand or didn't mm-hmm. like. And I actually would say start at the beginning, that billowy stuff. Read it as if it's poetry that mm-hmm. you don't quite get.
Mm-hmm.
And savor the good bits. And then go back and study with Adam or somebody.
Right. Mm-hmm. Good.
Thank you.
There are many groups of folks in town, but I know for sure that Adam Harvey, who you heard speak here, is leading a group that meets on most Saturdays at the public library. At the downtown main library, and there's a website, which I don't have memorized.
JoyceGeek.com.
JoyceGeek.com.
Joyce what?
Any more questions? Yes.
I just wanted to thank you for the multiplicity of psychological layers with which you presented Molly. I really hadn't understood her in so many different ways, and I thought it was so rich and spectacular and almost exhibitionist.
Keep talking.
The way you really enhanced her and approached her from all different directions, pun intended.
No, thank you. It's a tribute to Joyce, actually, the multiplicity of his characterization.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.